Welcome to Bike Tourist Podcast, show number 16. My name is Gabriel. Welcome to everyone, especially if you are new to this podcast. This show is brought to you in part by Adventure Cycling, the largest bicycle touring organization in North America. Visit them at adventurecycling.org. Randy Fay and Nancy Lewis are doing a bike tour from the North Pole to the South Pole. Currently, they are traveling through Mexico and have had many wonderful experiences. They have also created a podcast where they interview other bike tourists that crosses paths with them. I have personally listened to it and I like it very much. We have them here in the podcast for an interview, so grab a chair, get a cool drink, get a friend or two, and enjoy. Bike Tourist Podcast. Hello, Randy, Nancy, how are you?
We're good. Great to talk to you, Gabriel.
Hello there. It's nice hearing from you.
Okay. Tell us a little about yourselves and say hello to the audience here in the podcast.
Well, hello to the live audience in the podcast and in your fancy studio. We're Randy Fay and Nancy Lewis. Our website is hobobiker.com, and we're riding from the very far. Nancy says we're riding from the North Pole to the South Pole. We're riding from the northernmost part of the Americas in far northwest Canada, nearly at the Arctic Ocean, to the bottom of South America, which is Ushuaia in Patagonia in Argentina. And right now, we are in the little town of Huahuapan de León, Oaxaca, in southern Mexico.
Okay, bike tourists have always had some kind of motivation when they plan a long trip. What moved you to such a long bike tour?
Well, both Randy and I love to travel. We're very curious about people, cultures, language. And we decided that in order to do it up close and personal, if we rode our bikes, we would be able to see every inch of it. We'd be able to experience it very much up close, the weather, the smells, the people. We're such a curious item that this would be the way to travel. It's economical, and it's a phenomenal way to see the world.
We actually talked about this for years before we had ever done a bike tour of any kind. We said, well, you know, I think we'll ride our bikes to South America. But we'd never done any kind of bike tour. We were both cyclists, but we talked. And one year we were doing some planning, and we said, you know, if we're ever going to ride our bikes to South America, maybe we ought to try out cycle touring. And that was the year 2000, and we took our first 5-day cycle tour that year. And then we've been practicing ever since, until June 2006. We started from Inuvik. And it's real now.
Wow.
Here we are in Mexico.
So basically you are just starting grand, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Touring-wise, have your original trip plan have changed as miles go by?
We aren't that big a planners. So, for example, we didn't know what route we were going to take through Mexico when we got into Mexico. And we only made the decision of where to enter Mexico a couple of weeks before we did. So we're kind of playing it by ear. We only decided that we were going to go south via Oaxaca about a week ago. And so we try to pay attention. We try to ask a lot of questions along the way. Try to find out what the best route for a bicycle is. And so, yes, you could say that our plans have changed from the beginning. But overall, we're doing what we expected to do.
Mm. I see. Yeah.
I was going to add that it's really kind of dangerous when people tell us that there's this beautiful town in Oaxaca that we need to go visit, which is Oaxaca, and we're a few thousand miles away. Well, we kind of head that way. And along the way, other people say, oh, you got to stop and see Tallulah or Mexico City or Puebla. And so we say,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, we just keep on, you know, kind of heading for that direction. And we go and visit and we stay, you know, a few days, perhaps a week. And then someone else says, oh, you got to go see this town. It's really amazing. So our trip is changing. Our plans change almost weekly. But that's part of the adventure.
Oh, one problem that we do have with the with our lack of focus, I guess, is most people do this trip in about 18 or 20 months. They start in the summer up in the far north, and they end in the summer in the far south, and in so doing, they hit the rainy seasons about right on the way south, and they hit the summers on both ends pretty well. Well, we have dawdled and dilly-dallied, and we are in southern Mexico, and the rainy season in Central America is about to begin, and we're probably off track for the rainy seasons in Central South America as well. So our dilly-dallying does have a cost, and the fact that we plan to take longer than expected does have a cost, but we'll figure it out and we'll have a good time.
Uh-huh. We'll change our plans accordingly.
Yeah. Okay. So how much time have you been in Mexico for now?
Yeah, we entered in January, beginning of February, and today is May 20th. So we've been here about 4 months, and we still have another maybe month to go. Hopefully our visas won't run out, our tourist visas, and we'll get out of the country before then. If not, we'll renew it, and we'll keep on exploring. So we had thought Mexico was going to take about 3 months, and it's going to take about 6 months.
Uh-huh.
If we might even stay longer and do volunteer work. And miss the rainy season.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I have heard of other people that have done this. They just stay, they do some kind of work and raise a little money and continue on. It's bicycle touring has such flexibility on things that you can do and how you can do things. So on that same line, what have been your experiences in Mexico? And I am asking on both sides of the spectrum, good or not so good, so people can have an idea of the things you do. Since you are being there such a long time and having so much fun, I don't think that some wrong things cannot go wrong. But tell us, what have been your experiences, both good or bad?
You know, I can't remember any bad experiences. There's probably been some roads that were fuller of traffic than we would prefer. I'm sure there have been. But, you know, the people of Mexico have been so incredible to us. People have invited us into their homes. We've had so many wonderful contacts with people. They've been so friendly, so gracious, and we've loved the food here. You just wouldn't believe the variety of food. We're going to be sad when we leave Mexico because it gets a little blander and a little more predictable as we go into Central America and South America. The food is glorious. The things that we get to see are amazing. We've been to up in the north country. We went to in the north part of Mexico. We were in all kinds of colonial cities and beautiful places. Great history. The revolution. The Mexican Revolution and the Mexican War for Independence. And then we started getting into something that's not going to cease for us as the archaeological zones. Now that we hit just north of Mexico City, we started hitting famous, important archaeological zones that won't quit all the way into Central America. That they're almost overwhelming. They're just so interesting and full of life and stuff. But you have to pace yourself because there's just too many. As far as riding, do you want to talk about riding?
Yes, I would like to talk about riding.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're finding the Mexican drivers here are great. And the reason is that The roads are so unpredictable as far as what is on the roads. There might be a cow, there might be a mule, there might be a horse or other drivers. The signals, you don't really understand their signals for the cars. A right-hand signal might be, it's okay to pass me. No, it's not okay to pass me. And so because of the unpredictability, everybody is driving carefully and giving lots of room to everybody. So there's a large corporation of drivers here, and we're finding that it's a great place to ride. The roads have been, very, very good. And as far as the surface goes, it has been challenging because in Mexico there's lots of volcanic terrain. We did the Paso de Cortez, which was between two volcanoes outside of Mexico City. It was over a 12,000-foot climb, but it was absolutely beautiful. So the riding in Mexico has been great. It hasn't rained, which is really nice. There's been food everywhere. We can camp in the northern part of Mexico, and in the central part of Mexico, there's enough hotels that they're very economical. And people bring us home, and they're curious about us. They want us to go home with them and tell about our stories, and we want to learn about them. So we spent many nights in families' homes in learning about what it truly is like to live in the country of Mexico.
Yeah,
I want to add just a little caveat about our positive statements about the roads of Mexico. We wouldn't bring our 10 or 12 or 14-year-old kid, if we had one, on these roads. And we've been practicing and trying to become the best bike managers of traffic that we could imagine for a very long time. And so we're pretty good at handling the traffic. We have mirrors, and we use them all the time. We always try to know what's going on in back of us. We have maps. We try to use the best detailed maps and find the best routes that are going to be with the least traffic. And we feel like we are part of a big dance, and we are players in it. So you won't find us grabbing a hold and trying to hold our lane and to force the big truck coming up behind us to go around us. You'll find us getting off the road. If they don't have a way to get around us, we will just play our part of the dance and we'll get off for them. In fact, we both feel like we have the right and the ability to take any means that we need to manage the traffic and stay comfortable with it. And we're doing well at that, but we have an enormous amount of respect for the Mexican drivers, and they're showing respect for us, and we just appreciate it very much.
This is a nice statement, the traffic dance. Yeah, now that I think about it, it's real. It's like a dance, and everybody has a part of it. Wow. Okay, now that we are talking about streets and you talk about that there have been no rain. That's good for you. You are craving for some rain around here. It's so hot, so we want some relief. Okay. How have your luggage changed as this tour takes its course? Sometimes you take some objects, some equipment, and then you decide, this is not working, or this is working, or how have been your experience? How have your luggage changed as this tour takes place?
Well, there has been a couple major changes along the way. When we're in the northern part of Canada starting off, we actually had what's called bare boxes. They were containers that we stored food in that were crush proof and hopefully didn't allow the bears to get into our food. And we had to carry those because we were riding in grizzly territory as well as black bear territory. And there weren't many trees to hang the food from, so we had some beer boxes. So that's part of our luggage that we got rid of once we were in areas that we could store and hang food appropriately. We had winter clothes, such as down jackets. We had gloves, hats, you name it. So we have, as we've gotten south and now we're in warm climate, I changed the sleeping bag just last week. I have a 45 degree bag. Before I had a 20 degree bag. I also went shopping and I have now summer clothes because I got really tired of wearing the same 3 shirts for the last 5 months. So as at home, for women that changes clothes with the season, as cycling, it's really important to change clothes with the season also.
Yeah, I think it's hard to keep with fashion, I think.
Exactly.
And Randy, what do you have to say about that?
Well, we carry too much. We seem to always have too much. But our too much seems to have changed. We used to carry a lot of food, but in Mexico, we really hard to carry. Just a little emergency food is all we carry most of the time, because in general we find villages or something along the way, and we love to eat in the little roadside stands. We find marvelous food there, and so we prepare very little of our own food now. So we carry very little. We keep trying to reduce our load, but then we say, oh no, I guess we ought to keep that. So I guess we're doing okay, and we'll just keep doing okay, and we're enjoying it, so it's okay what we're carrying.
Yeah.
I'd like to add one thing. Sometimes we make error in getting rid of some clothes, and last week I actually made a trip home. I promised my family I'd come see them, and with that, Randy sent me home with his rain gear. Well, I got an email in the middle of the trip that says, bring back the rain gear, because he got stuck in a rain and it wouldn't stop, and he didn't have any rain gear, and he sat under a tree for quite a while shivering until it stopped. And so we have our rain gear. So hopefully we're making the right decisions, but if not, we'll improvise.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that about the rain, I would like to clarify for some of the listeners here that rain is different depending on the part of the world you are. For example, in the States, rain can be freezing, as well as the highest parts of Mexico and other countries. The rain could be explosion. But here in the Caribbean, rain is actually welcome. And when you're riding and rain falls on you, it's not cold most of the time, unless there is a cold front. So it depends on where you're going, and having rain gear is for most places makes sense. Okay, we know that our listeners would like to know about your equipment. It's about something about the technical side, because some people they are just thinking what bike should I take or equipment. Tell us about your bikes, panniers, and other things you are bringing with you.
I'll start. I actually started with up north with a traditional touring bike, which is a combination between a mountain bike and a road bike. It has a longer wheelbase, and used that for the first 5,000 miles. I did find that I wanted a better steering control in a more upright position, so now I am using a mountain bike, which is a specialized stump jumper. But I have added trekking handlebars, which are like a figure eight wide, gives me lots of steering control, because I need to sometimes get off the road fast, or we are on dirt roads going on adventure. So we are also, because we have a shock, okay, on the front, we can lock that out for the bumpy roads. We had to get special racks that would handle when we didn't have brazon hooks to fasten the racks on. Yeah. So the Old Man Mountain racks connect to the brake bosses go through the steerer.
Yeah, so it seems that they are like the Cold Springs or Old Man Mountain kind of racks, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the Cold Spring that we have. Mm-hmm. Old Man Mountain Cold Spring. I think it's called the Cold Spring Rack. Yeah, we have that. Yeah. And we're doing panniers as opposed to a bob trailer. I have pulled a bob trailer lots, many thousands of miles, and I love a bob trailer. But now we're using panniers. Mm. And we like them too.
Okay, what
we're using Ortlieb's. We're using Ortlieb's panniers because of the waterproofness, and they are holding up really well, and no problems with those at all.
Yeah, those are the same panniers since you started, or you changed panniers? What type of panniers? Have you been with your Ortlieb's in the beginning?
We've been with those from the beginning.
Well, Nancy bought new front panniers in Victoria, in British Columbia, because she had some off-brand weird things that weren't really much good. So now we have all Ortlieb.
Yeah, okay. Okay, one question is a different term from what we are talking about. Okay, some people have had problems with the drinking water. Some get sick one time or another there in Mexico. Have you had that experience?
We haven't. We have had pretty good health situation in Mexico. I won't say that we're not, with all the different foods and stuff, I won't say that we haven't had an occasional discomfort or something like that. But as far as being actually sick, Nancy was sick one day, and it was from a frozen seafood thing that some restaurant served her. And she got better after one day. We carry a water filter. It's so easy to buy purified water here. All of Mexico drinks. Everybody that can possibly afford it, all but the poorest of the poor, drink purified water, except in some villages they'll have a good well that they trust. But in general, Mexicans are pretty convinced about purified water, and there's a lot to be said and discussed about that. But they drink purified water, we buy it, or we filter it.
Or we boil it.
We do that for coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. We've been pretty happy with our health situation. We've been very pleased.
Okay, I know that sometimes good sense, common sense, it dictates actions that go in your benefit. But can you give you some advice to people that would like to ride in this region? What to avoid, because sometimes you say, if you do this, you'll definitely get sick. But if you do this and that, besides what you're saying, that boil the water, get purified water, do you have any other advice to people?
It will take some getting used to in any climate and any food when you go to a new area. So one of the philosophies that we started off with that we kind of adhere to, but we're a lot looser now, is that you eat food that's either cooked in hot, that's dry, mm-hmm. okay, or peeled. Mm-hmm. With that, we've been able to stay fairly healthy. We do brush our teeth with the water here. Other parts of the world, I know we won't be able to do that. But one of the things that I like to do is put lemon on just about everything. Mm. If I have a lettuce, I put lemon on it. It helps sterilize it. And then I think it's really good practice is at night time, make sure you have a beer or two with lemon as kind of to make sure that you clean out the system completely.
Mm. As far as the water. Yeah.
That's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah, gotta have some beer to stay healthy. As far as the water in Latin America as a whole, it's kind of a misnomer that Americans tend to have that what comes out of the tap is safe to drink. It's just, just the fact that you have tap water doesn't mean that that tap water is intended to be drunk. And there are many places in Latin America where you can drink the tap water, but there's no assumption of that in Latin America. And so essentially, we won't be drinking tap water unless somebody specifically says, "Oh yeah, it's great." It's just not an assumption that you can make, and then to be able to verify what somebody says is a little difficult. So we'll be filtering or buying or getting water out of the big garrafones that people in the States use for drinking water in offices and that kind of thing. Those are sold widely here, and a lot of times we can get our bottles refilled from one of those.
Yeah, I remember. I remember from the Spinning Southward interview, they mentioned about the garrafones too, and I think that this is it's been a very wide, widespread practice, and people have become conscious. In previous years, this was not the case, and I have not many people I know that have went there and drink water or have some coffee and they get sick. But I think that now that you mentioned that, and other people who have been through the region, including the Travises and the guys from Spinning Southward, things are changing. Okay, now let's move to the next question. Okay, have you had any serious trouble during your tour in general? You know, have you had any serious trouble?
Trouble with our gear?
Whatever. Trouble is trouble. Gear.
We certainly haven't had any trouble with people anywhere, right?
Uh-huh. No trouble with people. They've been great. No problems there. Equipment. We've had some challenges with wheels. And I do remember one time up on a dirt road up in Canada, a very lonely dirt road called the Cassier, that Randy's back wheel was broken. It was wobbling. I had to take the brake off in order to ride, and it was bad. And of course, when it's bad, it gets worse. So we're on the summit, and we're looking at the wheel, and it starts raining. And the rain turns to hail, and we go under. We throw our tarp between our bikes, and we're sitting there, and the rain is, you know, blowing. And we just sat sitting there, and it was a very discouraging moment, trying to figure out how we were going to fix this wheel miles, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from any kind of bike shop or tools. But that's the adventure. It's kind of like a treasure hunt.
It actually gets worse. There we are under the in the hail, looking at my broken spoke, which was on the drive side of my back wheel. And for the drive side, you have to remove the cluster to be able to change the spoke. And I had a special tool for that purpose that I brought. It's called a hypercracker. It's quite a famous tool. But if you don't use it exactly correctly, or if you apply too much pressure, or if your cluster's on too tight, well, it breaks. Well, I broke the hypercracker. I destroyed the only tool that we had while we were sitting there. And it was a little discouraging. We actually, a note on equipment, we did start with ordinary mountain bike wheels, 32-spoke mountain bike wheels, and we won't tour with those again. We've got 36-spoke wheels with hefty rims, and that's what we think. We're very happy with them so far. We've had no trouble on this section, even with some rough roads. Touring is just too hard on the wheels. When you get all that stuff hanging on your bike and you go over big bumps or dirt roads or going down, it's just too much for a traditional mountain bike wheel.
I would want to add that for any female that is touring, then knowing the basic mechanics on how to fix the bike in case of emergency is really important, because sometimes the rider that you're riding with will be behind or ahead, and you might have to fix the bike yourself, such as I did get a flat going down a mountain along the west coast of the United States, and I had to fix the back tire flat myself, and Randy had descended about 5 miles down 11% grade, and I flagged down a motorcyclist and told them to tell Randy I was fixing my tire. Well, he rode back up, you know, this 11% grade, 5%, just as I was finishing the last touches of fixing the bike. So being able to have simple bike mechanic skills, regardless if you're a man or a woman, is really important for self-sufficiency.
Wow.
And I think that way you, Randy and I think between both of us can handle a lot of mechanical problems, so it doesn't become a point that stops us from going forward.
Yeah, you know that.
I want to mention that.
Go ahead, Randy.
The little trick that Nancy mentioned is an important one for cycle tourists riding in a group of two or more, if you're in back and you have a problem and you need help, you can often ask a motorist to let the person that's ahead of you know that you had a problem. And you know what? When you're in front, you just wait for the other person to arrive. But when you're in back, flagging down a motorist and asking them to ask the person in front to tell them what happened is a great, great technique.
Wow. You know that the drive side spokes are my favorite tool to break.
Right. Oh, they're the ones they have the most press to.
Yeah. And my bike's tires are 32 spoke. They have been for the last 3,000 miles. They have been okay, but I have broken up more than one spoke, and it's getting tiring though. So I take your advice and get a 36 hole. I know I have told this to many people in this show, but you know, one tells one thing and then one do another. So okay. So now that you told us how you solve problem on the road, let's move to the other question. And I would like to ask you, tell us about the places you have been since you started the tour. Interesting places you have been.
Well, we started out in the wide, wide open spaces of northern Canada with beautiful landscapes and not very many people. We started out on the Dempster Highway, which is a 500-mile stretch of dirt road that runs down to Dawson City in the northern Yukon in Canada. And that was a great experience, a couple of weeks of very, very little supplies or support or anything, although we considered the RVs and the truckers that came by occasionally to be support vehicles in disguise. We didn't need them, but one night it was about midnight, and remember, it's light there at midnight, but it was about midnight, and we were stopped, and we were about to set up. We actually had just set up our tent just in front of a sign. I mean, there was no room, but we were by this lake. The mosquitoes were enormously intense, and we were just trying to get settled, and it was an RV that came up, and they said, "Is there anything you need?" And they offered, what did they offer? They said, we always said, well, do you have chocolate milk or caribou steak? And they said, no. And Nancy said, well, do you have a beer? And they gave Nancy, like, they wanted to give her a six pack. She ended up with three beers, and it was midnight. Then Nancy killed off those three beers, and she was wandering around this lake trying to fish at midnight with a tampon as a float to try.
In bear country, out in the lake by myself in the wild, because there was no tree, so I could see the bears coming, and I thought, well, if the tampon didn't work as a float, maybe it would knock out a fish. So I was drinking like a fish. I mean, thinking like a fish.
So from Canada, we rode down. It was a long... Canada is really, really big. We saw lots of beautiful country. We came down and we rode down Vancouver Island, which we enjoyed. And then we did the west coast of the U.S., which the west coast of the U.S. is a beautiful thing. I mean, you see the ocean every day with all of its variations. And riding from north to south, by the way, is the correct way to ride the west coast of the U.S. with the winds. But it's also the best way to ride because you're on the right side of the road looking at the ocean, and you get much better views that way. It's just no question it's the right way to go.
And for those that want to do this ride, the Pacific Coast Highway, they have what's called biker campsites. And every 30 miles or so, there's a campsite that's along the ocean or very close to it. And you can arrive at that without a reservation, and they have a large group site, and you can stay there. For $2 to $5 a night, they have showers for most of the places, and you meet so many other cyclists there. There's, you know, one night there was 20 of us cyclists from all over the world. We had this great shared barbecue.
Wow.
And it was just an amazing experience. Usually people that do camping, okay, are in cars or RVs that tour the West Coast. They have to have reservations months ahead of time. But as a cyclist, you can come in at any time, and you have yourself a a premium site for the most part. Some of them are by the railroad tracks or whatever, but most of them, the views of the oceans are just fantastic. The roads are a little tough because you have lumber trucks, big RVs there, but if you use a mirror and your head's up and you're willing to get off the road when you need to, then I think most people could handle it. But the views are just incredible.
Yeah, whereas most of what we did in Canada was certainly doable by a beginner cyclist as far as traffic management. I mean, there are lots of things to be managed up there. But before we got to Vancouver Island, almost everything you would take your kids on, you know, as long as you had all the logistics worked out otherwise, you'd take your kids and you'd know that the traffic management would be no problem. But on Vancouver Island, the west coast of the U.S., it's more advanced riding as far as the traffic. And some of it was a little irritating, a little too much traffic. But in general, it was so beautiful with the, I mean, how long did we spend? 2 months? Month and a half on the coast?
Yeah, September, October was the premium time to
and
ride there.
It was glorious. The views of the ocean were just off the chart. And it was so amazing. You know, we had met maybe five or six cyclists in Canada. And then we'd be seeing five or six. We got to where there was one night we pulled into a very nice campsite, a nice campground that had a hiker biker area in the redwood forests in California, and there were so many cyclists there that we just wanted to set up our tent and hide. We didn't have the mental energy to go hear all their stories and tell our story. And of course, since we've been in Mexico, we've met one touring cyclist. But it was astonishing how many potential friends there were there on the West Coast.
Yeah. So what about in Mexico or other places you have visited there since you crossed the border?
Well, you know, it's been quite different. The northern part of Mexico, the central part of Mexico, and now the southern part of Mexico. And it's, you know, there are multiple states here in Mexico. I think there's 32. And we started up in the Sonora Desert. It's wide open spaces, long distances. We rode up to Copper Canyon, got to go down to Batopilas, where the Tarahumara Indians live. Incredible place, just phenomenal. And to be able to see those people. And going down there, there's eight ecosystems, so go complete deserts to more tropical areas.
Six ecosystems, you said?
So six to eight ecosystems, because you're dropping down like 7,000 feet, and it's on this dirt road. For those that are extreme bicyclists, tourists, then they want to take their bike down. I'm not extreme bicycle tourist, so we stored our bike and we hitched a ride down there. Randy rode it down there a couple years ago, but I wanted to be able to have enough stamina to keep on going, so I chose not to ride.
Now the rim of up I won't call it the Mexicans call it, they don't call it the Copper Canyon region, they call it the Sierra Tarahumara. They call it mountains, we call it canyon. Well, I consider it mountains, really, really big mountains. So when you're up there on the highest, say near Creel, you're at almost 8,000 feet. And when you drop down to Batopilas, I think it's at about 1,000 feet. And so you can imagine what the ecosystem changes are as you're going down that.
Yeah, I might understand why they don't want to use the word canyon, because in canyon in Spanish is cañón, which is the same as a piece of artillery or a gun or something. So we just say mountain. I think we share at least that one thing. Go on.
Yeah, they do say Barranca del Cobre to talk about the specific Copper Canyon. They use the word Barranca. Mm-hmm. So we then, after a very long slog through southern Chihuahua and down to Durango, we took a bus from Durango to Zacatecas. It's very easy to take the bus here, which is a great option to have. We haven't been charged for a bus ride of any kind for taking our bikes or anything. The buses are inexpensive, incredibly better than anything we've ever had in the U.S. Far better quality, better service, and far more flexible. There's no boxing up of bikes or anything like that. Anyway, we took a bus from Durango to Zacatecas because the Mexican, the most important Mexican holiday of the year, the Semana Santa holiday, was coming up, and the whole country was going to be off driving their cars, and we wanted to be settled in one place. Oh, Nancy makes a sign, the classic Mexican sign of drinking with the with your hand. So the Mexicans are pretty famous for drinking pretty well during that two-week holiday as well. So we wanted to get settled, and we went to Zacatecas and spent an enormously wonderful cultural, they have their cultural week there, and we spent, we have a lot of things on the website about the wonderful things we did that week. We took a week-long Spanish language class, and Zacatecas was really a highlight for us. So we spent a lot of time, saw a lot of wonderful cultural events, and just enjoyed ourselves thoroughly. And it's a beautiful, beautiful city.
And that started our tours of the Silver Cities in central Mexico. They have what's called the Silver Cities because there was a lot of mining that they were able to mine gold and silver. And because of that, they built a lot of architectural with a Spanish influence, and it reminded me so much of Italy, Florence, city after city after city, incredible cathedrals, museums, and I was telling Randy that why would anyone want to go to Europe when Mexico is so close from the United States and there's such incredible rich music, dance, art, history, that I didn't realize that until I came here and started writing. We went to Zacatecas, we went to Querétaro, we went to Dolores Hidalgo, we went to
Guanajuato.
Guanajuato.
In every single city. Yes.
Now that you mention Guanajuato, sorry that I'm interjecting and cutting off like this. I read many years ago about one street in Guanajuato that is called La Calle del Truco. Were you able to see that street?
I don't remember it.
Yeah, the story goes about a person who was an avid gambler, and at some moment appeared this strange guy and challenged him to play. So they play. The guy lost everything. So now he was very worried about going back home and telling his wife about he has lost everything. So he said, you can get it back. Say, how? Just one more play. And so I have nothing. Yes, you have. Say, your wife. So you play your wife and you can get everything back if you win. So the guy, everybody said, no, don't do that. Don't do that. The guy did. And he lost. So... So when they got it was a real event. It was a real event, and he will go back to his home with the guy. I said, "Listen, you have to go with this guy. I lost you to gambling," and she dies from a heart attack. So but the guy even if she was dead, she's mine. He took her away and disappeared with the woman. So that's why this street where this gamble took place. It's called the Calle del Truco. So I thought you knew about that, but it's okay. So continue. I just got it off myself.
Kind of a follow up on what Nancy was saying. Some of these cities, not all of them. I mean, we've ridden through a lot of dusty rural areas of Mexico. In fact, by the time we got to Zacatecas, we had been through a long, long, long ways of desert and small little towns and unsophisticated places that are more like what some people's expectations of Mexico would be. And we arrived in Zacatecas, and what we found was a city, a world-class city, with cultural events and beautiful architecture that was in every way competitive with any place we've been in Europe. I mean, we've traveled together in Italy, and I would, Nancy compared it on the website to Florence, and that's a pretty big comparison, but for us, it ran neck and neck with Florence, of all places. Wow. Beautiful architecture, beautiful places, extremely wonderful cultural events, just on and on and on. It's just a great place, and then all the other classic cities of that part of north central Mexico, like Guanajuato and Querétaro, in San Miguel de Hidalgo. And Mexico City, of course. Mexico City is an off the chart, amazing. It's the world's largest city, and it's a city that deserves incredible respect from many different angles. But as far as culture and events and beautiful plazas and history, it deserves enormous notice. It's a more difficult place because of the pollution and the traffic, and the size of it is enormous. It's in a different class than all the other ones. But all those other cities, like Zacatecas, they're astonishing at the quality.
Wow.
Which leads on to that, we found that Mexico City area is basically a transition between the Silver City and the colonial cities into the old Indian, the Aztec Indians, the Toltec that we have now are going into the areas that there's ancient civilizations, and we're starting to see pyramids. The other day in Cholula, we were able to climb into an archaeological pit.
Oh, really?
That they were dusting off the bones of the skeleton that was buried there with plates, and it was their offerings there. And this was in the middle of this little town. They're redoing their roads, and because of that, they've had to have archaeologists on site. And because of that, we were there visiting one of the pyramids and going back to our hotel. And underneath the tarp were two people concentrating deeply on a small bit. And so we looked underneath the tarp. They invited us down. We climbed down into the tarp, and we sat there. And they explained that this skeleton was from the classical time,
wow,
about 1,500 years old. And it was, a nobleman, and they had found 17 skeletons like this,
wow,
burial sites through the streets of Cholula.
Yeah, wow.
So that's one of the experiences we're starting to enter into now, is the ancient people.
Yeah. How do you feel when you are being witness with your own eyes, just next to it, watching all these treasures that are being offered to your side, and you are there watching it? It would be an incredible feeling, right?
It's magic. It's absolute magic, realizing how the depth and breadth of humanity, and we're able to experience it on this little adventure. It makes me very humbled.
Mm. Now that I have this line of questioning, which is the place that you have liked the most, and why?
Oh, we've been to a lot of places, and
yeah.
We had such a delightful week in Zacatecas that it has to be right up there. We did a good job. You don't always do a good job seeing a place when you're bicycling through. You know, you kind of feel like the next destination is calling to you. You feel like you ought to be on your bike. And that week, we knew what we were doing. We were staying put. We were trying to see Zacatecas and enjoy it. And we went to Spanish school, which was delightful. And so that was definitely up there.
Up there, there's two of the things that bring to mind. You know, Zacatecas is full of its history. And the other two things that just get me just amazed and humbled is, of course, the tundra up at the Arctic Circle, and to be able to see that in its richness, and the moss and the colors, and the bergat, and just the open space. So that has a magic to itself. Another location that I really enjoyed was at Elk Meadow, where they have redwood forests.
Oh yes, it was Prairie Creek Redwood State Park, in the middle of the Redwoods National Park in Northern California.
Wow.
And we spent an extra day there, and walking among the redwoods there, we asked one of the rangers what we should do or what we should see, and he made a very emotional, passionate statement that if he had one day with his girlfriend that he wanted to show her the very best that he could ever show her, he would take her to the redwoods, and he would hike the path that we hiked, which walks through beautiful, incredible redwoods, you know, you're looking up and you're in a tropical rainforest of redwoods, and we walked to a beach on the sea, then we walked back. It was absolutely glorious.
Wow. So this is just the expression the forest guard did was just right to it. It was right on, right? Wow, it's incredible. You know, you are mentioning all those things, and I'm just in my mind traveling there and watching the things. You know, it's a different thing when you can imagine and when you see with your own eyes. But you're doing a pretty good job. You know, I'm creating such a vivid images in my mind. Yeah. Okay. Well, one question I have: do you have any before we move on? Do you have any other favorite place? Because you have many favorite places that you have experienced in your tour. Do you have any other favorite place that you would like to share with us before we move on to the next question?
Yes, there is one other place that's really special, and that's whole rainforest and the coast in that area, which is in northern Washington. On the western side of the Olympic Peninsula, and the whole national rainforest is actually in the Olympic Peninsula, and the tidal pools at low tide, to be able to see the amount of
Claylock.
Is that the Claylock?
Claylock is where the tidal pools were.
And they had anemones of all different colors and starfish, and it was such a healthy coast. The pools when it's tide is filled with all this life, and then just going in, taking a road and just going in to the rainforest and just walking along around again the redwood forest and the jungle vegetation there, and that particular area is just enchanting. It's just I wonder how long it will be alive and so pristine.
But you know, we have to say something else too. The actual highlight of the trip is the people, not the places. I mean, all these incredible places we've been, but the people
right.
that we meet are by far the stars of our experience. There was a day that we were riding out of the Copper Canyon region, and we landed in Bayesa, Chihuahua. And we got there a little late. We don't believe in riding after dark. It's way too dangerous in any part of the world. But it was a little bit after dark, I have to admit. And we pulled into town, and the hotels were too expensive, or we couldn't find them, or it was just a little town. There wasn't much there. And there was a connection made with a woman who was actually just driving us around in her truck, and she just invited us home, and she took us home, and she made us stay for the whole weekend.
Wow.
And we became the uncles or aunts of the family. They didn't want us to go. You know, we were there on Friday night, and we stayed on Saturday, and they said, "Oh, stay on, you know, tomorrow Sunday. You know, stay. Help us make tamales." So I learned how to make tamales from scratch.
That's great.
For the father of the house was a rancher, and he had brought home a skull of a cow, and the skull was sitting on the table after they had boiled it, and we got the meat off of that, and she ground up the corn, and we made 200 or 300 tamales by hand.
Wow.
From that we learned about the town and the people, and on Monday we planned to go, and he wanted us to stay one more day because he wanted us to go out to the ranch
for one more week.
But they were so incredibly open in inviting us in. They had two kids. The grandfather was there. The cousins were there. Josefina was there. I learned many things on really how to laundry clothes by hand.
Laundry in a lavadero.
See, and hang it up.
Wow.
And how to make tamales. It was just an incredible experience. So people are very, very open and accepting to us, even though we're stranger and we're outside of their norm. They're just very, very generous here in Mexico, and fun-loving and gentle people. I've just been amazed at the gentleness.
You know, this is one thing that we try to emphasize here in the show. I tell people and other bike tourists that have been here in interviewing would say the same thing. Don't believe what you see on TV. all that have been said, that especially from people who have never had the experience of having so close, being so close to other people and sharing those experiences. I think most of the comments come from people who simply don't know. And, you know, all now that you tell these things, it's such a wonderful thing when humans in general, I'm not talking about American, Mexican, or European, I'm talking humans in general, when they share what they know and what they like with other people, this is such a great thing that people just forget about differences. And in these cases, the difference are what become the real treasure, when you can share your difference with other people. This is just great. This is just great. Do you have something more to add before we move on?
No, I think we probably have said enough.
Yeah. This is like, you know, when you get something that you know, that is so delicious, just start eating and eating and don't want to stop. Okay. okay, what is the most challenging aspect? What has been the most challenging aspect of this bike tour?
I would say that the elevation, the climbing with a loaded bike has been challenging in Copper Canyon. I do remember it was very, very hot, and I had to walk more than I'd like to admit. And as I walked, I cried. And as I walked and cried, these three kids were walking passed me up the hill with their soccer balls, and they walked much faster than I did, than I could ride. And I was thinking, what am I thinking that I can do this? but, you know, crying is very therapeutic for me. And it got me to the top. And
you're not alone. You're not alone.
So I got to go down. Randy is very patient, and he'll wait for me, and I'll see him every half hour or 5 miles, whatever.
Oh,
you know, we work together, and we are doing this together, and Randy could probably ride twice as much faster and much further and probably lighter, but he'd do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more valuable that we're doing this together. So together, it's our trip, and so we work together with it.
I think probably for me, the hardest part that I remember was that section, you know, that section up on the Cassiar Highway up in Canada. When you're doing bike touring, especially a long tour like this, your moods affect what's going on and your challenges. And that was a hard period. I think I hurt a muscle in my back in Whitehorse as we were leaving for the Alaska Highway and the Cassiar. And so I had some just ordinary daily pain. And then we started having the wheel problems, and it felt like we would never get them solved. And it was hundreds of miles that when I trued that back wheel without the spoke, of course, when you try to true something without a spoke, you get a radial lump instead of an axial lump. I don't know whether I got the terms right or not, but anyway, basically, with every time the wheel went around, I went ba-doop, 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 and I was always wondering when it was all going to go completely to hell and fail, and that it was just going to, that I was going to just be out in the middle of nowhere, and we were going to have to hitchhike or something. We spent a lot of time dealing with that, and it seemed like a big challenge, and it was rainy in that time.
It was rainy, and I don't think our nutrition was that good. Randy was really low, and I don't think we were able to eat the vegetables and the variety of food. So knowing basically that he was off, we got some vitamins, and we got into a new area and off the Cassiar, and things changed. But we came up with plan A, B, and C, that some people will just have plan A. And if plan A doesn't work, then they throw in the towel. But with us, we had plan B. And which was basically, if this doesn't work, we'll find some place and rest for a week or two. And if we don't like that, we'll go and find another place and rest until we're able to regroup and continue. But we were able to basically get it together and keep on and going.
One thing I should mention, that every bicycle tourist should know, especially somebody who's new to bicycle touring, is that you are going to have a very discouraging day or a couple of days. And that often happens when you're tired, when you've gone too many miles, or you've gone too fast, or you haven't had enough rest. I can't tell you how many stories I've read of bicycle tourists who had that experience and quit. They just were so mad and so upset and so down that they quit. Whereas if they had just stopped, gotten a motel, spent a couple of days resting, they would have been fine to go forward. Because between the physical and emotional stresses and all the things that you have that are part of bicycle touring, you have to remember that sometimes your emotions aren't really connected up to reality. And when that happens, the usual fix is rest.
Okay, that's good. Okay, now we're going to move into a different topic. And I think it's one of my favorite topics, I have to confess. Tell me about volcanoes in Mexico. Have you visited any of them?
Well, we are not experts on volcanoes in Mexico, but we did ride between two of them. And on the eastern side of Mexico City, there are two huge volcanoes called Popo and Ixta. Popocatépetl is the name of Popo, but Popo and Ixta is a lot easier to say. And Cortez, when he invaded Mexico, when he invaded the Central Valley of Mexico, he came over that pass, so it's called the Paso de Cortez. Both of those volcanoes are well over 17,000 feet high, and the pass is at about 12,000 feet. And we came over that, we came into that area, we looked up. Popo is such an amazingly perfect volcano. It's huge. The smoke is coming out of the top. It's not in a dangerous explosive situation right now, although as we approached the area, there were billboards saying, here are the risk areas. Which area are you in? Figure out where you are. There's different, so they, since Popo is right next to Mexico City, of course, it's a very important thing to have evacuation plans and that sort of thing. But Popo, since it roared to life a few years ago, has been just kicking off smoke most of the time and not doing any great damage. But beautiful, beautiful volcano. We'll be seeing plenty more, especially in Guatemala and Costa Rica. But Popo, have we seen any besides Popo and Ixta? And then there's one to the east of Puebla that we saw.
Nope, that's it. So,
what about Paricutín? Paricutín is not active right now, right?
Paricutín. We went to Paricutín, the Paricutín volcano, on our 2003 mm-hmm. practice trip to Mexico. And Paricutín is a volcano that in the 40s just appeared in a farmer's field. He was just working away, minding his own business, working his cornfield, and all of a sudden, a volcano started coming up out of it. Paricutín is in the Michoacán state, and it is a pretty impressive because it basically engulfed the entire village where it was, except for the tower of the church. And I had read about it when I was in the fourth grade. That everybody in the fourth grade, they read about it in their My Weekly Reader. And I remembered it from when I was a kid, hearing this incredible story about a volcano just appearing in a flat farmer's field. And we rode our bikes there in 2003 and walked to the volcano and looked at the beautiful church spire still sticking up out of the lava and looked up at the volcano. It's not anywhere near as impressive a volcano as Popo, but very, very interesting and delightful, and the story behind it is so interesting. And it is no longer active.
Yeah, you know that in regions where there are some kind of volcanic activity, the kind of soil is better for agriculture and for nature. Near those regions, did you experience any regions that are have such kind of terrain and vegetation due to the volcanic activity? Have you seen something similar?
Well, as we were climbing up to the Pasay de Cortez, we saw along the whole hillside when we were about 20 miles outside of the saddle or the pass, is the rich soil where the farmers were plowing and planting by hand the fields. And it was early morning, and the light was kind of orangish, and it was a little bit hazy because we were near Mexico City, or it was the time of year, I'm not quite sure, but the land was really fertile, and we'd been in very dry areas for a long time, and all of a sudden, as we climbed up, it was richer and richer, and the forests grew out of that, and the grasses, the wild grasses, and it was really nice to be able to climb up into a forest where the air was fresh. We'd been in the Mexico City area for a couple of weeks, and I started being able to breathe easier, and it was quite different. You know, it creates water, it creates fresh air, it creates trees, and so it's a self-fulfilling environment, and it was really a pleasure to be able to ride in that area.
Okay. Before we continue, I have some cookies here for the dog that is with you, I don't know if I can Skype them to you.
Oh, you know, the dogs here in Mexico live on the rooftops, cause, like in the cities. Uh-huh. It's so weird to be able to ride your bike through a little town and up there's a huge dog looking down on you. And we were in Zacatecas at nighttime. We were walking around with a marching band that follows, goes around the whole city. This group of people hired a marching band. And as we're going up and down the alleyways at nighttime and the marching band is playing, there's this big dog that looked down from the second story roof and was barking. And the whole band stopped and they pointed at the dog. They changed songs and they played at the dog. About 12 musicians played right at the dog, which, you know, instigated the dog to be more, you know, agitated and barking more. And then in the middle of the song, the 12 musicians stopped and barked back at the dog.
Everybody in the crowd barked back at the dog.
And then continue playing. So, so that dog you hear is on top of the rooftop. So we'll get him some cookies.
Okay. The other question I have: how did you or are you overcoming the language barrier? You know, you're native English speakers, and this is Spanish where you are. How are you overcoming that barrier? Because not everybody is successful doing that. How are you managing to communicate with people and to share? Because so from what you tell, you're doing okay. But is there a special recipe for doing this kind of interaction and overcoming the language barrier?
Well, the secret is, to be very fluent, like Randy. he's always studied Spanish. He lived in Ecuador and Costa Rica and has traveled to Latin America. So he's had many, many years. He's been a student of Spanish all his life. Where I am in a whole other class that I started, and I've been speaking Spanish now for about 4 months. So I'm a real beginner. And I find the secret is, to attend Spanish school. So we attended a 2 weeks of Spanish school. But the biggest thing is to smile. Because if you can smile, you can get people's patience. And you can, I often say, you know, I don't speak Spanish very well. No habla bien español. But can you help me? Pero quieres un baño. And because of that, I'm smiling, I'm looking them in the eyes. They're very patient, and they'll try one more time. And so I think if you know how to point towards something, and if you say it wrong, be willing to have the correction, you enlist them on your help, and therefore you enlist them in your life, and you learn about them. And it's the real key of looking people in the eye and smiling. And also having a partner that speaks really well when things get out of hand. And you really need to be able to have good instructions to get what you need done. But for the But I'm coming along because I'm open and I smile a lot.
Okay. What are your plans for the months to come?
Well, we're a bit in flux right now. We're really getting fairly close to Central America now, to Guatemala. And so we are going to maybe plan A is that we are going to see if it works to ride during the rainy season, and if there are regions that we can ride through that work. Or plan B is we have a number of things that we had intended to do in Latin America that require a longer term stop. One of them was that we have always intended to take some of the time during our trip to do some volunteer work and that sort of thing. And we've also planned to do a more extensive language school stay. And there is the wonderful Roatan area off the coast of Honduras where there's lots of inexpensive scuba diving that can be done. And so that is another option. So we're gonna see what comes, but once again, we're in flux about what we're doing.
Okay, tell us about your podcast. You created a podcast that you put on your webpage. Tell us about it so people can go and listen.
Well, we've always had a website called hobobiker.com, and we started that about 6 years ago. And we started with just journaling and photographs. But as technology is advanced and the advancement of iPods and little recorders and cameras that take video, we've expanded into a semi-multimedia website. And with that, we decided that it'd be fun to do an oral story rather than just written. And I have a little iRiver that records sound. So we started recording some of the music we listened to in Zacatecas and some of the folk music. And from that, we decided to start recording ourselves and other people's and our experiences and sharing that with our friends and family. So, because sometimes we miss them and they miss us, and to be able to hear our voices and to know that we're really not that far away is very important. And then, you know, oral history is a part of a recording history throughout time, and so we're just taking that and using that available technology. And we've posted a couple things on our website.
Mm. We would love to have any of you. Our website, again, is hobobiker.com, and the podcast is at hobobiker.com/podcast. And you can also, if you use iTunes, you can just search for Hobo Biker and you get it right away. So that's as easy as pie.
Okay. Do you have any other web projects or projects, personal projects that before we wrap this thing up, other projects that you would like to share? Because many bike tourists are active in other projects and stuff. Would you like to share with us if you have any other thing around about since bike podcast, bike touring?
We have a brand new project that we've actually been one of the few bike tourists that doesn't have any sponsors or any big projects. We figured that we just wanted to do our ride and not have to bother with anything else. But we were really, really impressed with Tim of PushOnNorth.com, who is raising funds for Doctors Without Borders. And he was very successful in raising some funds for that very worthy organization, and we've been thinking about that ever since. We're very impressed by his style and how he did that. And so we have found an incredible organization called Kiva.org, Kiva.org, and we're going to start promoting them. They're a microcredit organization. Microcredit is where you loan maybe $200 or $300 to somebody so that they can start a tiny business or improve a tiny business in the third world. And Kiva.org is making it possible for first world people who, for $200 or $300 is nothing to many of them, to be able to loan directly to third world entrepreneurs who $200 or $300 makes a difference in a whole step up or a whole new business. And so Kiva.org is a matchmaker on that. They seem to have done their business, their background research very well. They work with on the ground organizations who qualify the borrowers. And we're going to start promoting that with our website and try to make that our charity that we're trying to raise funds for and encourage people to make loans through Kiva.org to third world and especially Latin America, since it's our area of interest, to make loans to Latin American tiny businessmen, microcredit.
Okay, that's really nice. Okay, Randy and Nancy, it's really great. Really great to have you here, and you know, what you have described to us in your adventure is really eye opening, and you have created many special images in our minds. So let's say goodbye for now, and maybe we can reconvene in the future as when you have much more things to tell us about your travels and interaction with people. So thank you very much for being here, and I hope that everything goes well for you.
Thank you, Gabrielle. What a treat.
Thanks for having us on board, and we look forward to hearing more of the podcast from your site.
We always listen to them.
Okay, thank you very much. So this has been the Bike Tourist Podcast. Goodbye to everyone, and until next time. So, this is it.
Well, good. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was great chatting with you. I think you've got your editing work cut out for you.
Yeah, you know, let me see if this thing is this recorded in the computer.